At about 500,000 years ago, half a million years ago, the hard hammer technique gave way in part to, you got it, the soft hammer. Soft hammer technique is not really soft. You can't use marshmallows or bread to remove flakes, but it is softer than stone. You can use especially antler, bone, and even hard wood like oak or ash. Now, the reason soft hammer technique came into, one of the side effects of the appearance of soft hammer technique was a much straighter cutting edge. And this little thing that I made right here, we'll send around, you can see how deep all of those scars are. Because with the hard hammer technique, I'm producing a very deep negative bulk percussion on the core, for example. So if I made a hand axe like this with hard hammer technique and I looked at the edge from the side, it would be very jagged like this because of the very deep negative bulbs left from removing those flakes to change the shape of this thing. Soft hammer technique, giving you a clue, does not have as large a negative bulb, or it does not have as large a positive bulb on the flake. Instead, look at the edge of the flake again in the striking platform. It would be a slightly detectable bulge. It's a much thinner flake is produced with a thinner bulb of percussion, usually a smaller platform, and as a result will also produce smaller, thinner, negative bulbs, negative ripples, positive ripples. Sometimes it becomes very difficult to see the ripples or even feel the ripples with your delicate thumb on a flake produced by the soft hammer technique. Usually, you can see that, or not usually, but often, you can see that hard hammer technique was used to rough out a tool, and then it was finished. It had a second series of retouch with the soft hammer. So you'd start out with a very jagged edge like that, then they would take the soft hammer and straighten that edge out, producing a very fine, sharp cutting edge straight, where it would be a much more effective butchering tool, especially, but also a woodworking tool or a tool for cutting hide or whatever you want to do. So at a half a million years, soft hammer technique comes in and it produces much more efficient tools, simply because of the effects of using a soft hammer producing less noticeable factors compared to the hard hammer technique. The soft hammer technique appears, the hard hammer technique does not disappear. In fact, the hard hammer technique was used until people stopped making stone tools. There were some things that you could use a hard hammer technique for. It didn't make any difference if you had a straight edge. Maybe you just wanted a sharp edge immediately and you left your bone back in the tent or something, and you just chop away with a jagged edge. The soft hammer technique appears at a half a million years, but the hard hammer technique, in fact, continues all the way up to just a few thousand years ago. But if you start to, let's say you pick up a flake or a tool with barely noticeable bulbs, or negative bulbs, or positive bulbs, you know that you're talking about something that is less than half a million years old. But if you pick up a hard hammer flake, you cannot say that the thing is 2 million years old. It may be only Bronze Age or the Bronze Age. They still use it then. Now, the soft hammer technique, it carries sway on the fine tools for a very long time, until about 35,000 years ago. With the appearance of all of those blades that I was talking about, we encounter something called indirect percussion. or it's also called the punch technique. So this shows up around 35,000 years ago. It actually doesn't become extremely popular until about 25,000 years ago, but we do see it's used a little bit earlier. Indirect percussion means that you're not striking the tool directly. Okay, there's something that's going to happen between the hammer and the tool. Very often this will be on a core, especially. Instead of striking the striking platform with a stone or with a bone or with an antler, instead you put probably a piece of antler on the edge of the core and then strike that with a stone. This is the punch, and the improvement here is you can remove that blade from exactly the place you want it to come off. When you're just using your arm and trying to strike someplace on the edge of that core, you can't control it perfectly. You're going to be missing back and forth. And as a result, some of the blades you produce are not going to be even approaching what you want it to come off. But once you put that punch exactly where you want it, now you can just hit that thing and come off almost perfect every time. In the Upper Paleolithic, that period of our physical and cultural development that begins at about 35,000 BC, you'll get some magnificent blade cores like this that look almost like works of art, primarily because all of these regular facets that came off were produced with punches, so they could remove those blades exactly from the right spot. Now, as is the case before, at 35,000 BC, we do not lose the hard hammer technique and we do not lose the soft hammer technique. These are still very important techniques, but especially for the production of blades, these long, regular blades with exterior facets that are parallel to the edges. This was one of the best techniques for producing. There is another kind of punch technique that doesn't even involve percussion. And this would be the pressure punch. In this, the core would be held in a vise, could be stuck in the ground, in sand or something, and a large chest, what do you call it, a chest punch, I guess. Piece of wood here, with a piece of bone down at the bottom stuck into it. You would just lean on the core and push off long, long blades. Now this may be how these long cannoneum blades in the Bronze Age, early Bronze Age, were produced. Here again, you can use a lot more pressure and you can control that pressure a lot better than if you're striking something. You can't really control exactly how fast your arm is going to be moving. So this would be a pressure punch technique, which leads us into another technique altogether called the pressure technique. On the pressure technique, we don't use the movement of the arm at all. Instead of removing parts of an edge or removing flakes from a core, using force by striking it, what we do is instead push pieces of that edge off. Let's say that we wanted this blade to be perfectly straight on both sides, or we wanted it to come to a symmetrical point. By striking the edges here, even with a soft hammer, the blow may be too strong for the delicacy of the tool itself, and you might just simply snap that blade. So instead, by, let's say you have a piece of wood here with a small tip of antler stuck into it, you can instead just, it takes a lot of power, and you can't do it just by leaning on something. Push off the parts that you don't want to be there, changing the shape of the edge exactly as you want. It's sort of like the punch technique in the sense that you can control exactly where you want that stuff to come off. Very efficient way of changing the shape of an edge. The pressure technique begins actually about 18,000 BC in Europe. It then died out at about 15,000 BC and was never used again until the Neolithic, especially here in the Near East. Pressure technique begins in the Neolithic and becomes one of the major ways of especially producing spear points, arrowheads. One of the characteristics of pressure technique retouch is, first of all, you cannot see with the unaided eye the quote pressure platform. Okay, if you pick up one of these small flakes, you need a magnifying lens to see the point at which you push that thing off. And it'd be a very feathery, teeny flake, varying size from less than a centimeter to maybe a centimeter and a half. Very, very thin. There, of course, would be no ball of percussion. There is no percussion involved. On the tool itself, you will get this nice, long intersection of very, very flat facets. You have to almost hold it up to the sun to catch the glint coming off these facets. Generally, you can kind of picture in your mind now how nice and feathery this kind of retouch would produce, changing the shape. Again, pressure retouch would have to be used on something that's very small, for the most part. Trying to change the shape of a hand axe, for example, with pressure plate, you give yourself a corneal thrombosis or something, your head would explode probably. So it's primarily used for very delicate instruments, especially arrowheads, spear points, and other thin things that you simply could not produce with, or probably would not be able to produce with soft hammer retouch. So going back through this as a summary, if you find a flake that you suspect is made by hard hammer technique because of those pronounced features that we were talking about, it could come from any time in the last 2.5 million years. It is not a very good dating method at all on the basis of the technology. Soft hammer technique, you know that it's not any older than 500,000 years, roughly. Indirect percussion or the punch technique, you know you're talking about that stage of human development at the oldest, that stage of human development when we are already Homo sapiens, not more than 35,000 BC. And when you come to the pressure technique of retouch, here in the Near East, you're talking about the Neolithic, and later, Neolithic, Chalcolithic, and early Bronze. So we can use it in a very rough sense for dating a site from where the material comes. Now I'd like to back up again a little bit in time, during the time when Neanderthals were, during the time when Homo erectus, or that grade of ancestors of ours that immediately preceded the Neanderthal man, as Homo erectus was changing to Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, or the Neanderthal group, we see the appearance of a special kind of soft hammer technique. This is called the Levallois technique. Has a very French-looking name, and that's because it's named after a town in France where it was first recognized as a separate kind of flaking technique, Levallois. The earliest claims for the use of Levallois technique go back to about 500,000 years ago, almost at the same time that the soft hammer technique itself appeared. Now, this may be true. These are claims made for Western Europe. I, on the other hand, tend to doubt it. First of all, the numbers of these very early Levallois points and flakes and blades are very, very small, and it seems to me that these could be produced by accident rather than by design. For the most part, the Levallois technique is not used, at least very much, until after 250,000 BC. This technique, as I indicated, involved the use of soft hammer technique, but it directs that technique into a very special way. The normal, in fact, we will distinguish between Levallois technique and normal technique. When we're producing flakes from a core, the normal way to approach it is to take a stone, knock off as many flakes as you feel like doing before perspiration gets into your eyes, and then go through those flakes and look for flakes that might be suitable for whatever you want to do. You may find none that are completely suitable, so you retouch the edge. And their relatives had discovered a more efficient means of producing flakes, a variety of flakes, where they could more or less control the shape of the flake that came off. They would not have to waste a large amount of stone in order to find a couple of flakes that might be suitable. And this could be very important depending on where you are in the world, because flint does not grow on trees or grow out of the sand or something. By pre-shaping the core, by removing flakes from that core in a special way, you can control to a very good degree the next flake that comes off. Now, we would take this stone that's got a lot of cortex on it, and we would direct our flake removal always towards the center, overlapping the facets a little bit until we had remove all that cortex. Now, I say that we remove all the cortex. That seems to be the normal method that these people use. Cortex was not one of their more popular kinds of stuff on their flake tools. Now, once we've done that, we have all of these facets pointing towards the center of the core. Okay, centripetal. Facets. Now, once I've got that all taken care of, I prepare a little part of the stone there to give myself a flat surface, another striking platform, and the next flake I take off is going to be circular, primarily controlled by those facets that all point towards the center. The force that goes through that stone now is going to be bouncing off like mad, but mostly it's going to be controlled by these facets. Okay, these are going to be different little traffic cops, if you will. So when that flake comes off, I know that it's going to have a roughly circular shape. Usually it's going to be thin as well. It's usually removed with a bone hammer or an antler hammer. And the Levallois technique is very easy to recognize because those centripetal facets are still going to be on the edge, on the exterior surface. If you hold up this thing to the sunlight, again, all of those ripples are going to be pointing towards the center, more or less. So that's a good Levallois flake. Now, this is the Levallois flake technique. Okay. Now, the same thing can happen by preparing the core to produce pointed flakes, or the Levallois point technique. Again, start off with a stone. And remove a series of flakes that always go diagonally across that stone. Removing long flakes like that. And now the next flake, what I want to do is direct it down the intersection of these diagonal scars. So again, I prepare a platform, strike it there, off comes a flake that will come out pointed like that. And it'll, you can just about predetermine the length of that point you want and the width of the point, depending on how many of those first few facets you put on that score. And once you remove this one, it's going to leave another facet you can take another one on, right behind it. Subsequent points are going to be bigger. And you might even be able to get another one off if you can hold a spear that big. That's what these things were, spear points. We suspect they were jabbing spear points. Probably not arrowheads, because you'd have to have a bow about the size of that window to shoot it. So this is the Levallois point technique. Again, it's pre-shaping that core with diagonal facets before you strike off this predictable point. And finally, we have the Levallois blade technique. And it like its predecessors, you start out with a stone, and now you just keep on knocking off flakes in this direction or in that direction. You can use them both. Call it unidirectional Levallois blades or bidirectional Levallois blades, if they come from both sides. And again, now anything that comes off there is going to, again, controlled by these facets, or those ridges on the edge of the core, surface of the core, thing that comes off is going to be primarily, I mean very predictably, long, parallel edges, and parallel facets. So this is the Levallois blade technique. Now, as I say, these begin at 250,000 BC, roughly, especially here in the Near East. They have a very strange distribution. Some people see some groups of Neanderthals or their relatives. I say this because Neanderthals actually are from Germany. Over here we can't say they're Neanderthal, we can call them Neanderthaloids. Or what does Howells use? Collaterals. We'll just use Neanderthaloids. Okay. Some Neanderthaloid groups here in the Near East found a fascination with the Levallois technique. There was a large site down near Schoback Castle. About 6 hectares in size, where the ground used to be covered with Levallois flakes, Levallois blades, Levallois points, and Levallois cores, along with a lot of hand axes. Yet out at Ein Lessed near Osrock, found out of maybe 2,000 flakes, 2 or 3 Levallois flakes. They obviously didn't even want to make Levallois flakes. Is this distribution because they were doing different things? Are these for use in a special way? Or is it that the flint at Ein Lessed was not good for making Levallois material? Or was flint so prevalent out there but scarce down at Schoback that these people had to make, or it would be better for these people to make Levallois material because flint was more scarce? So they would make these things to predict the shape rather than destroying rocks, looking for something that might be suitable. We don't really know. We have to spend a lot more time doing surface exploration before we can say anything about that. Now, something about lithic technology, which in fact is not really... Oh, yeah. Before I go on to this point, let me share one more point about producing stone tools. And this is heat treatment. Now, as I've said, flint is, in general, almost glassy in terms of its properties. Especially, you'd be able to see some flint you can even look through. Or, you can't look through it, but you can see light coming through it. translucent flint. Very excellent quality material. In fact, that would be probably the preferred kind of raw material for use because it does behave so predictably. You can still increase the quality of that flint by heating it. Slowly heating it in a set of ashes or a set of coals to a certain level. You don't want to get it too hot or it's just going to explode. By heating it slowly up to a certain level, you can in fact anneal those crystals. It becomes more and more like glass, like obsidian, for example. This is called heat treatment, and it is generally fairly easily distinguishable. First of all, the surface will be extremely glossy. It will look almost like glass. Secondly, on the surface of the flake, usually it's used on blades, you can see very teeny hairline fractures. These form because it wants to explode, but you haven't quite made it hot enough. These little hairline fractures go in all different directions. Intersect, it kind of looks like maybe there's hair inside the flint sometimes. This is called crazing. I don't know why it's called crazing, but it is. But these two, plus, there usually will be a change in color, very often towards the reds. Okay, so a brown or even a gray flint you start off with, after heat treatment, will become pink or red, a variety of red colors. Now, this of course is not going to be good if you're in an area where the flint originally is red, but there's very little red flint around here in the Near East anyway. But the glossiness and the crazing will also be very good clues. Another good clue is if you're at the site and you find a lot of this glossy, crazed material, some of those cores especially will not have been treated just right, and you will see, in fact, fire explosions. The fire explosions this is the flake, and we struck it off here. The fire will cause parts of this to heat up faster than others, and you'll get generally round pot lids, they're called. They're just round things popping off, and these will have a flat, a surface that was like the exterior or the interior surface of the original flake. Let's say it's the interior. So it would be flat, and then it would be almost perfectly symmetrical round or hemispheric. Okay, that thing will just pop out. This also happens not only with heat treatment, but as I said before, out in the desert, the sun, the change in temperature from the sun will also create big spalls like this, heat spalls. And we've got one of them right here, a very large one that just simply popped out. But if you find a lot of these little teeny ones in a site with a lot of crazing, some that around, then you can be pretty certain that they were indeed putting these things in the fire or in the coals and heating them up very slowly.
Is the heat treatment done on the core stone or on the tools?
On the core. Yeah, this way you can change a lot of the stuff at once. Maybe you can do it on the blades too, but I'm not sure. I'm not aware of any anthropological studies of groups who still use stone tools doing it. It seems to me it would be more logical to do it on the core. We have a lot of cores from Kirani, for example, that have been heat treated in the upper Paleolithic. Fascinating. That's a fascinating site, and it's really sort of inspiring to see how well they can control this stone tool technology. It's a magnificent material.
This is where
you find the Kirani? Yeah, that's where Mujahid Mahaisi finds it. Now, at Ain Ghazal, we're going to see a lot of results of heat. Not so much in heat treatment. I don't think we found any heat-treated material yet, although a couple of pieces might be. But in the village of Ain Ghazal, it looks like they were building their fires and moving them around a lot, or they were just throwing stones into the fire. In any event, there was a tremendous amount of rubble as you're excavating out there, if you're going to work with us, that has nothing to do with artifacts per se, other than being brought to the site to have a lot of people. But for the most part, you're going to get very angular chunks. Usually they're going to have black and red stains on them, black from perhaps the heat itself or from the charcoal. They sometimes have very deep concave holes in them. Other times they will have unbelievable contours. After a while, it'll be very easy for you to recognize just chunks of what we call in the business fire crack rock. It's a very highfalutin word. These may be simply the rocks that were around the hearth at a time, or it may be that they just built their fires on top of a layer of stones, not for any particular reason, but then these stones just start exploding. A lot of the rubble out there is from this, and there's nothing in there that gives us any information, so we're just throwing the firecracked rock. Otherwise, we already have more than a ton of material to analyze it. So if you find this, check it with your square supervisor now and then, and pretty soon you'll find out that you can tell just as well as he or she, and you can start chunking yourself. It's no fun to wash all of this firecracked rock, just to throw it out later on. Well, that just about covers the technology part, lithic technology part. I think, on Wednesday, we'll talk about the site at Ein Ghazal, the pre-pottery Neolithic period in the Near East. This Ein Ghazal.